KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. American independent filmmakers might envy Celine Sciamma, director of the French film Portrait of a Lady on Fire. She had no problem getting funding for her lesbian romance set in the 18th century. And for that, she credits France's support for filmmakers.
We have this great system, but this system has consequences. It's the fact that it's very bourgeois, very also old, white, male-driven. And I think there's a resistance. And, you know, I understand why we are dangerous.
Sciamma tells us about the contradictions of filmmaking in France, a country that funds breakthrough female directors, but also celebrates Woody Allen and child rapist Roman Polanski. She talks about discovering that women painters and feminist art critics were thriving in the 1700s. And she breaks down the detailed choreography that goes into planning sex scenes in her films. But first on the News Banter, the hunt is back on. Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, The Hunt. You know, I wrote about The Hunt back in August. This was a movie that's from Jason Blum. He is the guy behind a whole array of films, The Purge movies, Get Out, Whiplash, lots and lots of movies. The Hunt is a movie that was meant to be a satire. It was elites who kidnap so-called deplorables, that's a word used in this film, which I have now seen, putting them on this remote manor and hunting them. And they give them weapons, but it's not really a level playing field. And this movie, it's a very violent movie. So in the summer, in August, when there was the spate of back-to-back shootings, we reported that ESPN had declined to air ads that were starting to roll out for the release of this movie. And then ultimately, it became hugely controversial and Universal pulled it from the release schedule. But we are talking about this because the film is now going to be back on the release schedule for release in March.
Right. Once Fox News jumped on this, it was really clear that Universal needed to pull this movie, and they did smartly before it spiraled out of control. Now the question is, 6 months later, it's back and it's rolling into theaters, and they're really trying to take advantage of this notoriety in the marketing. They're putting out ads that say, you know, come see the movie that no one wants you to see.
It's the most talked about movie of the year that no one's actually seen. That's the tagline they're using.
Right. And I don't know if that's going to add to the box office. It's a $14 million movie, so it doesn't really need huge box office, but maybe people will be more inclined to go see it because of the controversy.
Yeah, I mean, we should just sort of state that this was not just the Fox News machine, but it was also Trump tweeting about the movie, not by name, but very obviously referring to it and saying how sick it was and how racist it is and all of that sort of thing. There were threats against the producer, Jason Blum. He said he had to get more security. And what he and Damon Lindelof, who co-wrote the screenplay, Damon Lindelof, most recently known for Watchmen on HBO, what they said to me is that they didn't even, they say, see this as something that was like third rail, even though it uses the language of elites versus deplorables and people hunting people. They say they really thought it was a satire and it was even-handed and did not take sides. And they also say that they screened the movie for a test audience a couple of days after those mass shootings, and people seemed to enjoy it, and nobody said that they thought there was any connection. Nobody brought up a connection to these mass shootings. So they are acting as though this caught them off guard. I will say I've now seen this movie. It's not the movie that nobody's seen. I've seen it. It's really violent. It's definitely going to be a hard R. You know, they would say it's cartoonish violence. I'm squeamish, so you know, I still had to like, ugh. But yeah, it's a question mark as far as will the publicity help it. They're opening it on 3,000 screens. That's very wide. So we don't know if it plays like a horror movie or people get into it. It's going to be interesting to watch.
I don't know if I believe them that they didn't understand that when you call people deplorables in a movie, it might cause a negative reaction amongst the people that were in that Hillary Clinton comment that sparked the phrase being so well known. But, you know, they're selling a movie, so they're going to have a spin.
Well, certainly Damon Lindelof says he hopes that this would actually by shining a light on this terrible problem of division in the country, maybe help heal the division. I'm not entirely sure how.
Yeah, that sounds like something that 10 publicists contributed to.
No, I don't know. Damon Lindelof is a very bright guy who can think for himself, but look, he can hope. Well, let me pivot to a new film label, Warner Max. Very recently, Warner Media, which is the home of HBO and Warner Brothers and the new HBO Max streaming service. Warner's and HBO Max say they have this thing called Warner Max, and it's going to be a joint venture. It's going to make up to 10 movies a year. And this was a press release that went out. And another thing I wrote this past week, this did not go over well. You think the town where movies are challenged and the idea that there would be a buyer of up to 10 movies a year for this would be for the HBO Max streaming service, collaboratively made by Warner Brothers and HBO Max, like people would say, yay, a chance to make up to 10 mid-budget movies. And that's just not what happened.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. These mid-budget movies are exactly the kinds of movies that either the major studios aren't making, or when they do make them, they're so challenged at the box office that you almost always get negative headlines about movies underperforming. So you'd think that doing these kinds of movies straight for streaming might be the way out. But I think there's a sense here of a loss of a legacy studio. Warner Brothers has always been the crown jewel Hollywood studio that treated talent well and had blockbuster movies and
Oscar contenders, and a range of movies. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like the full service example of what a Hollywood studio is. And this press release is an admission that that model no longer works for all but certain tentpole sequel type movies. You are swimming upstream, and if you can find an out, you take it, and this is an out. You are going to make movies directly for streaming now.
Well, yes, and the other thing that really pushed a lot of buttons in my reporting is that, you know, first, the question that you're alluding to, does Warner's then make fewer movies and a narrower range of movies? And most people think that is yes. And the other thing is that, you know, HBO Max, the streaming service, is seen so much now as the 800-pound gorilla at this company that it is the priority of the owner, AT&T. Everything is in service to it. So Warner Brothers, the film studio, is subservient. And even though they announced this as what they call a unique joint venture between HBO Max, the streaming service, and Warner Brothers, the film studio, there were so many executives listed on it with such a sort of opaque, complicated reporting structure. The quote that we used in our story from an executive who has long done a lot of business at Warner's was, "It does seem like too many people on a press release screwing in a light bulb." There were six executives, and it wasn't so clear who does what. And the fear right away, even though they put the name of Ann Sarnoff, the CEO of the Warner Brothers studio, first before that of Bob Greenblatt, who is the head of HBO Max, I think people thought that's misdirection because we all know what is the important thing at this company.
I think the press release was a bit of a misdirection, but the proof's going to be in the pudding. Now Bob Greenblatt has to take these disparate corners of the Warner universe and make them work together to create a coherent strategy that produces films that will still generate hundreds of millions of dollars at the box office, and then has this second tier of films that will be tailored more for the streaming crowd and lead to a subscriber increase at the streaming service. And it's going to be a difficult road because, you know, what does a theatrical movie look like these days? Or do you wait till you've actually made the movie and then decide whether it's good or bad and put the bad stuff on the streaming service and the good stuff in theaters? That's not a way to grow your subscriber
base. Well, at which point the streaming service side says, we're not taking your failed movies. So this is a fraught situation. I will just note that at this time, at least Bob Greenblatt is not in charge of the Warner Brothers film studio or the Warner Brothers, the overall studio, but it does feel that he kind of de facto is driving the bus. And as someone said, and another executive who does a lot of business there, you know, there's a lot of streaming services coming onto the field of play. How much can be sustained? And if this isn't a winner, then what? Does AT&T stick around forever? What happens? That's what everybody's, one of the many things everybody's worried about. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The French film Portrait of a Lady on Fire is opening just in time for Valentine's Day. The movie, set in the 18th century, traces the dawning of a passionate romance on a desolate island off the coast of France. Marianne, played by Noémie Merlant, is an artist who's been summoned to the island to paint a portrait of the mysterious Héloïse, played by Adèle Hanel. Eloise is to be married off to an Italian merchant she's never met, and her portrait will precede her arrival in Milan. After a difficult journey to the island, an exhausted Marianne arrives carrying two blank canvases on her back.
Je suis peintre.
Marianne learns she's not the first painter to have attempted the portrait. Heloise has chased off another male artist by refusing to pose. Heloise's mother tells Marianne she will have to work surreptitiously, acting as a companion while studying her subject's features to paint them later in secret. It's not long before those long, searching looks, which Heloise reciprocates, lead to a romance that both women know can burn brightly, but not for long. Portrait of a Lady on Fire is directed by Celine Sciamma, and the film is distributed by Neon, which also released director Bong Joon-ho's Best Picture winner. We are talking to Celine right after the Oscars. She was lucky enough to be at the celebration for Parasite, so she stayed up very late.
Yeah.
Or very early.
Yeah, but happy to be here, and it was quite an historical night. There was a K-pop concert.
A K-pop concert, yeah, I saw that.
That was quite cool.
So that was the coolest party.
Yeah.
So now we have your movie. To make a film like your film, that would be enormously difficult in the U.S., right?
Yeah.
Borderline, almost impossible. Mm-hmm. But what about in France? Does France still support this sort of thing?
Yes. It's my fourth film, so I have the trust of the industry. And we have this incredible, unique system with a lot of public support for cinema.
You mean financing, of course.
Financing, mm-hmm. Yes. Portrait is a 4 million euro film.
Right.
It's kind of cheap for a period piece, and it was my most expensive film. And the process for financing such a film in France is basically going through the National Center of Cinema, where there's a board that actually made of professionals, so you can be part of that board and then also be applying for the grants. And it's basically your script gets chosen for its quality.
Right. That's the idea.
And not connected to its potential
box office. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I've been lucky enough to never actually face a difficult financing situation.
Wow.
It's an incredible system. What can I say? We are very privileged. That's also why I guess we have the most, we're 25% women director in France.
But you're aiming for 50%.
Or 60, you know?
Well, I mean, minimum 50%, I should say.
Yes, because I mean, we are the country with the most women director, but the figures are steady for 30 years. So, and also when we look at women's career, like we make less film, we had less budget, you know, they love to discover us, but then we tend to disappear.
Mm-hmm. So you have to be a phenomenon and then that's that. Thank you for that. We're moving to the next phenomenon.
I mean, especially if you look at festivals, we get access to the parallel sections of the festival. That's where we discovered. And then the glass ceiling to access to the official competition is definitely there.
You have an unusual way of working, I think. I read, at least for 3 years, you were sort of just thinking about Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Yes. Well, I feel like you should have a lot of desire for the film you want to make. And also, it should matter a lot. And I like to think about it for long so that it matters. But it's especially the case with this particular film because I can be a fast writer. I hope I will go back to fast writing also. Yeah.
But this one was the slow cooking. So I read, and we're not going to do spoilers, of course, but that the final image of the film is the starting point in your mind for the film.
Yeah. That scene, that whole final scene was the first thing that came to my mind. It was like a vision that became a compass then to write the film. It was the first time that I knew where I was landing before actually knowing what this will all tell. And then basically started daydreaming about this, not thinking too much about, not trying to craft a story. I was daydreaming about several things, actually. The idea of a film dedicated to a love story and that would embody the process of falling in love very passionately. They would depart from the convention of love at first sight in cinema. And that really to look at desire, to film desire. How do you do that? And also wanted to show women artists at work. And that's when I started doing some research about women painter, and especially at that moment of the 18th century. So it was this...
Yes, that was a real thing. There were really professional women painters in the 18th century, which I think a lot of people don't know about because they're lost mostly to history.
Yes, there were hundreds of them. There was also a very strong female critic scene, and they were looking at the work of female artists. And I read some archives about, you know, the Salon du Louvre, which was kind of the Cannes Film Festival for painting. And you could just read those critics out loud today, and it would feel definitely still... Things haven't changed.
I mean, are they writing from a feminist point of view at
that yes.
point?
And also the male critics being sometimes really despised the work of the women painter. It's like there was already female gaze going on at the time.
You talked about the danger of a woman director sort of mimicking the male gaze, mm-hmm. which is something that mattered a lot to you, I think.
Female gaze is a hard work because it's departing from convention. It's basically trying to deconstruct and unlearn what you've learned from films. So deciding to, like, for instance, create a love dialogue without a power dynamic that relies on domination or conflict is a lot of work, because when you're writing conflict, you feel like you're writing. You feel like you're doing cinema. So it's scary not to rely on those tools that everybody feels comfortable with. So female gaze is also about that. You know, it's not about, are you going to show a woman shirtless or not? You know, it's really about, yeah, what kind of power dynamic you bring to the screen and how do you write your scenes, where they begin, where they end. And that's also the process that took me a lot of time.
Your film is very elliptical about sex.
Yes, it is, even though there is, I hope, erotic tension, and there's a sex scene in the film that is as an idea within. And I think that's mostly what we're missing in other representation of sexuality in cinema. You know, it's like you don't put your brain into it. Like, and the actors, they say that a lot. I mean, Adele talks way better than I do about that sex scene because she has more experience regarding this matter. And she says it's always lonely and it's always a moment where suddenly the director doesn't have like an idea. It's like it's always, they are handed the scene, like do the sex scene.
Right.
You know? It seems like there should be like a strong intellectual idea in it. I mean, I try to make it humorous and fun also, you know.
Is it sort of like a man director saying, just, you know, do this and make it hot? Is that really the most reductive way of putting that?
I don't know. I don't even think that they're saying make it hot. I think everybody's being really, really shy. Mm. And sometimes also a little bit, we can be cowards about this, giving the actors the entire responsibility. I know things are changing here. I know that here you have like intimacy coordinators.
Intimacy coordinators, yeah.
Yeah. Like in France, they would see that in a very, it would mean, oh, maybe our freedom of speech is going to be reduced by this.
Right.
Whereas I see it as like, well, if you're doing like a car crash in a film, you will have a stunt person. If you do a fight, you have the stuntman giving you the right angle. It's mise-en-scène so that you would believe that people are actually fighting. So why should it be the same?
Well, and not get hurt, right?
Like, yeah,
which can happen. We've seen it happen.
And make the scene better and more believable and more, also more sexy and more comfortable for everybody. Mm.
So how did you go about achieving that in your film?
Well, I think intimacy on screen, whether it's a sex scene or just also a seduction scene, is a lot. I try to think about it in a very musical way. So it's mostly about the rhythm, how many steps you're going to take to get that kiss. Are you going to breathe in or breathe out? I try to be there for my actors to be accurate. For instance, this breathing thing is really important to me. Like if you end the scene with somebody exhaling or inhaling, it's not at all the same thing and it's not the same music. And it's like, so most of my solutions, they are about the rhythm and the melody, and I'm giving indication in that way.
It sounds almost like choreography.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Coming up after a short break, Portrait of a Lady on Fire director Celine Sciamma tells us that in her home country, all eyes are on the upcoming César Awards, the Oscars of France. Her feminist lesbian drama will face off against the most recent movie from Roman Polanski. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on the Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on the Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to French director Celine Sciamma. Her newest film, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, is in theaters now. The movie tells the story of Marianne, an 18th century artist sent to a remote island off the coast of France to paint a portrait of Héloïse, who's betrothed to a man she's never met. As Héloïse has refused to pose for this portrait, her mother has commissioned Marianne to act as a companion while studying her subject and then painting her in secret. In time, Héloïse learns the truth and agrees to sit for the portrait, but Marianne is dissatisfied with her rendering of Héloïse's beguiling smile.
Je n'arrive pas à vous faire sourire. C'est comme si j'avais l'impression de le faire et qu'il disparaissait. La colère finit toujours par gagner. Chez vous, c'est certain.
The formality of the language is so striking. At first, I was waiting. I thought there would be a moment where they would go from the vous voyez, the formal, to the tu, toyer. But even the mother speaking to her child says vous.
Yeah.
And that was a convention of the, even the, when they're lovers, it's still vous.
Yeah.
But it's a thing that doesn't exist in English.
Yeah, I know.
And so you can't translate it. Mm-hmm. But it never changes in terms of the, even in bed, vous. So
there's two moments where actually they switch to tu.
I missed that.
Yeah, the opportunity of using the vous was part of the great pleasure of writing these dialogues, I must say. There's a sexy distance to it. That makes a difference.
Now I have to go back and re-catch the tu.
I will tell you when we off.
They're off mic, so that's for me to find out. Okay. I understand that you sort of work as a costume designer on your films.
I did, yeah, I did the costume design on my previous film, which was good shopping. But it's often the case, it's often the job. And yeah, and this time, obviously, I wasn't competent for that job.
But you did have pockets in the dresses because they initially said there were no pockets, but then you found out that there were pockets.
Yeah, there were pockets. I mean, I wanted each character to have one costume. And I wanted to share the intimacy of these women, which means you have to share the loneliness. So basically, yeah, what's their attitude when they're not being looked at? And the costume was really important in that process. And to, yeah, design the silhouette of the character and this idea of pockets, yeah, was really important for me. People find it anachronistic.
Yes.
And it's not the case. There were pockets at the time. Women had pockets. And then the 19th century took away the pockets from women and with a lot of their rights. And we still don't have our pockets back. It's still an issue. And I know that now there's even a political movement within designers who are actually giving.
Yes, I think it should be illegal to make pants for women that don't have pockets.
Yeah, but it's all because they didn't want women to have secrets.
Right.
You shouldn't.
That was the concept.
Hide,
don't hide anything. It takes away that privacy that you can have your own thing.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to the question of France, I think you've said that the film didn't perform as well as it might in France, and you think it's because of this issue of the male gaze.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, yesterday we just finally made 300,000 tickets, which is what my previous film had made. But I was expecting, more, not double, but like, and maybe I'm not the good person to analyze this, but it's weird because we had more power than before and more support. I mean, we had the Cannes Film Festival. a casting that is, you know, identified and a lot of support from programming and, you know, a lot of cinemas, and it didn't happen. There's also always this idea, when is the film released? And we were facing James Gray, and Ad Astra was a big success in France, and also Woody Allen, who did really, 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 really good. So sometimes it's also about that kind of timing. But I must say, since Cannes already, the international critic versus the French critic, there was already kind of tension here. France is a very, very also bourgeois industry, very privileged. As I've been telling you, we have this great system, but this system has consequences. It's the fact that it's very, very bourgeois, very also old, white, male-driven. And I think there's a resistance. And, you know, I understand why we are dangerous.
So it was better reviewed by international critics than domestic. And your film, the other disappointment is it wasn't chosen as Oscar contender.
Yeah, but I'm here.
And here you
are. I was a Golden Globe contender.
Yes. Do you see that as part of the same thing?
Well, I don't know, because I feel politically aligned with the film that they picked. Les Miserables, which is an independent film. You know, we are in the same category budget-wise.
Director of color.
It's like politically, I'm totally aligned. I feel we are allies, you know. So it's not like they would have picked something that was...
the bourgeois white man movie.
Exactly. And also, L'Agile's film is a box office darling in France. It did 2 million tickets. So
wow,
maybe
that is a lot.
It's embodying France.
It's of the moment, maybe.
Yeah,
in a way.
Maybe. So
who knows? Mm. You mentioned that Woody Allen was having a big success. You know, as far as this country is concerned, he doesn't really exist, hardly. I mean, he's a memory. Mm-hmm. And yet in France, which leads me to the current success of Roman Polanski as well. And I don't know if you have a position on that.
Award season is starting in France. We have Les César, which is our Oscars. I mean, I have 10 nominations. He has 12. We're going to be competing. And it's a strong political tension.
There's a controversy around Roman Polanski.
Yeah, of course.
I have not been shy about saying this guy seems to be a child rapist, right?
Oh, of course. No,
the question is, artist, art, do we say, well, let's just look at the movie? Or do we say,
no,
this is not acceptable and we shouldn't be supporting it?
Yeah, of course. And there shouldn't be public money in it. And mostly, you know, but in France, the debate is very violent, very hostile to feminists. Basically saying that, you know, this is censorship and that it's a puritanism. So we're having a very hard time. So it's like, this is hard. Plus, we get all this hostility. And he's not experimenting any censorship of any kind. He has strong support. He made like millions in the box office. It's like they're thinking backwards, like he's persecuted by feminists.
The
and
victim,
that's,
yeah.
And, you know, when we're talking about separating the film from the man and the man for the artist, he basically said himself that this film was a metaphor for him being persecuted by feminists. So, I mean, he's not separating himself from his art. And, you know, as a woman director, as a female director, we are never separated from our art. Never.
So you just have to kind of live with it? I mean, because there is that culture in France where there have been, he's not the only accused person who is completely tolerated.
Yes, it's a very difficult climate, I must say. But for once, the political alternative is in the room regarding this award thing. So, I mean, we're going to see what the Academy is doing. It's 5,000 people. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have a good picture. And I think this night is going to be looked at by not only France, but internationally. And you know what? I really don't know what's going to happen. But, you know, in France, you can't have best film and best director.
You can't win both.
You can't win both. So
they could split the baby.
So there's a real chance that he might win.
It's almost too perfect to have your film competing against that film.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like somebody wrote that script.
Yeah.
Céline Sciamma is the writer and director of Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Thank you so much for coming with 3 hours of sleep.
Thank you for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program, and Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.